Good evening. We're going to get started. This is the third part of a lecture series on a Torah of sexual ethics, disappointment, honesty, and growth. And I do want to thank folks who braved one of the biggest blizzards in New York City's history and its aftermath to come here in person. It's great to see you here and great to have folks joining online as well. The way we grow as Jews is by paying attention to the stories that we tell and retell. This is one of the ways we grow as Jews. And in fact, it's like really kind of crazy that we literally tell the same stories every single year. We read the same stories in the Parsha every single year. We read the same stories for the holidays every single year. And the only way that it doesn't feel rote is if when we tell those same stories, we grow in how we tell them. We tell and retell differently. And if we don't make sure to grow in how we tell our stories, how we tell the same stories year in, year out, not only might we stagnate, might we not grow, but these stories can actually cause harm. So as we're close to Purim, we're going to focus on sexual ethics as it relates to the story of Esther and how to work through disappointment we might feel when we tell this story from this angle, honesty, and ultimately towards growth in how we tell this story that we feel like we already know. And I want to give a shout out to an organization, Sviva, that does a lot of work each year around honoring Ta'anit Esther the day before Purim, leading into the night of telling the Purim story, as a day to recognize those who have experienced sexual victimization and to realize that it's an important thing to gather in that light before jumping in to the story in the Megillah, which can really be quite hard when we pay attention to that story that we're telling. So we'll begin by looking at a couple of verses in chapter 2 of Megillat Esther. And I want to focus on asking the quote-unquote right questions. What are the questions that we ask when we read this story of Esther? And what are the questions that we should be asking when we read this story? What are the questions that our tradition has asked of the story of Esther? And what are the questions that we, as those who inherit our tradition, what are the questions that we need to be asking? Okay, so we're here on source one, Megillat Esther, chapter 2, verse 2. This is after Vashti has been kicked out, which we could have talked about that part too, but I want to focus in on this scene. Okay. The king's servants who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for your majesty. Yivakshu lamelech ne'arot bitulot tovot mar'eh. Let your majesty appoint officers in every province of your realm to assemble all the beautiful young virgins at the fortress, Shushan, in the harem, under the supervision of Haggai, the king's eunuch, guardian of the woman. Let them be provided with their cosmetics. Yikbitsu et kol na'ara bitula tovat mar'eh el Shushan habira. And let the maiden who pleases your majesty be queen instead of Vashti." The proposal pleased the king, and he acted upon it. So that's our scene, which we often know of as the beauty contest, which when you pay attention to it, is really a kind of abduction scene of all of these young virgins. When the king's order and edict was proclaimed, and when many maidens were assembled in the fortress Shushan under the supervision of Haggai, Esther too was taken, vatilakach Esther, you might say abducted, into the king's palace under the supervision of Haggai, the guardian of the woman. Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus, vatilakach Esther, again, she was taken, or what we might say abducted, in his royal palace in the 10th month, the month of Tevet, in the 7th year of his reign. So this is our scene, which I think is particularly hard to read when we are so aware in so many headlines in this very moment about trafficking of young women, and to see this scene of literally amassing, right, abducting all of these young women for the sake of the king's sexual pleasure is a very difficult moment to actually take in. Now, there's no reason to think this is historical, and it's quite likely that part of why this scene is here in the literary genre of the Book of Esther is actually to show how kind of debased the empire of Ahasuerus was. And yet, I think we have to just make sure that as communities, when we are reading this story, which again can feel like the story that we already know, and sometimes we almost let it, we might even kind of like glaze over at the words that feel so familiar, to understand what's happening in this scene is very important. Okay. Now, one question that our tradition asks on this story that you find in the Talmud is, I want to say, not the right question. But it is important to confront this question as it appears in our tradition, because often we in our own communities and cultures might be asking the not right question. And the question our tradition asks, to some extent, is what should Esther have done in this situation? She's abducted into the king's palace. What should she have done? And I think part of what we see here in one of the Talmudic passages that brings up this story brings us back to evening one, where there can be so much misunderstanding of what an experience of sexual ethics gone wrong can involve. Okay? So we're in source two now, Bavli Sanhedrin, 74b. And this is in a longer discussion where the Talmud is asking, what are the sins where a person has to be willing to die rather than commit the sin? And it's a chapter in the Talmud that is often discussed as a chapter on martyrdom, right? A discussion of martyrdom. And in some ways paints this picture of a hero who could avoid sin. And it becomes extremely difficult and complex when that sugya gets into the question of sexual sin. And we'll see here that it sort of has a motif that is not uncommon in literature of late antiquity and before that, which imagines some way that a sort of heroic feminine could somehow manage to escape a sexual sin being inflicted upon her, right? That is a product of coercion. Right? As we saw in this chapter, chapter two, right? Esther is described very passively. She is taken. She's abducted. It's within a whole system and structure that is abducting all of these young women. And the by being able to sort of ask this question, well, what should she have done, assumes all sorts of parameters of agency that might or might not actually exist when one is faced with this kind of coercion. Okay, so here's what the Talmud asks about Esther in this context. Veha Esther farhesia havai. But Esther was in public, right? When she's taken into the palace of the king, and this sexual sin is, when she's being confronted by the sexual sin of being forced to be with King Ahasuerus, the sugya here seems to suggest, well, since this was public, she should have been willing to essentially do a kiddush Hashem, right? To die rather than commit the sexual sin. There's a whole discussion there of what exactly the sexual sin is, but in some ways, it doesn't matter that much in that sugya, because in that context, in that passage in the Talmud, it's been determined that any kind of sin, even a relatively small sort of sin, a person should be willing to die rather than commit that sin in public, in particular. Okay, so this is this sort of fantasy and image of this feminine hero who would somehow, right, be able to die rather than commit this sin that's being forced upon her, and also be willing to do that. Okay. Now, so the point is, the Talmud has a problem with the text of Megillat Esther, right? How could it be that Esther just willingly went along with this situation instead of being willing to die to avoid this sin? It's, I think, one of these moments where, if we're honest, it's a moment of disappointment in the text that it could imagine that this is even always possible in the face of coercion. Okay, the response, Amar Abaye, the response is also difficult here, but perhaps in different ways. Abaye's response is, Esther karka olam haita. Esther was ground of the earth. Esther was ground of the earth, karka olam. It's not entirely clear what he means in this setting. It's often read as passivity. She wasn't doing anything here. Meaning, is his response to the question that comes before is like, what do you mean? She should have actively stepped in and been willing to die to avoid the sexual sin. She wasn't being an active agent in any way in this context. Right? She's being faced with coercion and she is totally passive. It's almost, there's like a gap in the language or grammar to even use the kind of active language that would suggest she could have actively decided to die to avoid this. And she wasn't active at all. She was passive. She was under duress. And this was something that was done to her where she wasn't an agent at all. Okay. So on the one hand, I think this approach may kind of reflect an understanding of a sort of paralysis that could occur in the face of an instance of sexual coercion. But it's also kind of troubling in inserting such a level of passivity, especially when Esther in the story in general is kind of one of our least passive characters in the Tanakh, right? As a woman. And if anything, it seems like Esther, certainly as you read on in the Megillah, is making all sorts of active choices in very unideal circumstances that are tactical active choices to deal with a situation that is not one she would want to be in. And yet, within that scenario that she's facing, she's going to maneuver and do so in order to save her people. But this passage in the Talmud does not use this language, but we might have wanted it to use the language of Avera Lishma, right? She maybe is knowingly kind of almost seducing the king when she's in those parties in order to do what she thinks the moment calls for to save her people, right? And so I think that kind of awareness of what's happening in the pshat of Megillat Esther and how active of a character she is makes it a little bit hard to see this language that describes her as so passive. Okay, but I kind of want to say that there's not really any good answer you can give when the question you're asking is how an individual who is facing the kind of sexual coercion Esther faces in a structure where literally so many of these young women were being, I don't know if trafficked is the exact right word, right? But being taken for the sexual pleasure of a man in power, right? If the question just becomes, well, what should the individual do in that moment? We're not really asking the right question. So I want to move here to source three, which I've taught before, but really had to teach in this moment on the eve of Purim, which is the question that we should be asking is not just trying to judge what should this individual stuck in the structure do or not do. The question we should be asking is, how do we profoundly shift our culture so that individuals are not stuck in these terrible situations where there are no good choices? So that's not really the question that the sugya asks there about Esther. a sugya that is involved in questions of martyrdom and individuals. But I do think it's a question that a later commentary in the medieval period leads us to. And I just think we have to appreciate the power of changing the question in order to retell our stories in the ways that will allow us to grow. So here's how I think we see a shift in the question in this source. This is source 3, the Ritva Rav Yom Tov Asevili of Seville, 13th century, when he is trying to understand the kingdom of Ahasuerus and the sort of sexual ethics or non-ethics that pervades that society. So he says, Malchut Ahasuerus, v'chayotzebo, the kingdom of Ahasuerus and any other like him, Shehaya ohev nashim is the Hebrew. He was a quote-unquote lover of women, though really a better translation would probably be abuser of women. V'chol she'ones isha b'malchuto lo haya makpid. Anybody who raped a woman in his kingdom, in that culture, did not care about it. It wasn't something that really registered because of his own practice and the tone that he set as a leader. That was what that kingdom was like in our world today. We might call it a sort of rape culture. That is what chapter 2 leads you to. If you have a society where all of these young virgins can just be taken and brought to the king, then nobody anywhere is going to care about sexual ethics and sexual abuse. So he says, because of this, right, therefore, anyone taken by Ahasuerus was legally considered a captive. There are certain halachic ramifications to that, where the presumption is a sex act that occurs under coercion. The fact that they didn't scream, the fact that they didn't resist, the fact that she might not be willing to die isn't because they're a willing party, but because there is no one to save them, because they know what kind of culture they're living in. They're living in a culture where nobody cares. And because of that, you can't really judge their action or inaction to resist this kind of behavior, okay? So the main thing I want to take away from this, there's like a million words here that we could unpack and go in a lot of different directions on how to disentangle this a little bit more. But the main thing I want to take from this is, right, to move the question to what kind of culture do we live in and what kinds of choices exist or don't exist by virtue of that culture, instead of kind of zoning in a judgmental way to ask, oh, well, what should Esther have done or not done in that situation, right? What should an individual, did they do the right thing or did they not do the right thing? If the culture is set up badly, there is no good thing to do when faced with that situation. Okay, so that is sort of stage one here. We tell the story of Esther year after year. We witness that scene year after year. And we need to ask the question of what produced a culture where that was possible. Again, not necessarily historically, but what can produce a kind of culture where this is possible in our own moment. And I think what is really profound, I saw this quote just quite recently in an article in the paper. And this is a quote from Rachel Lloyd, who's someone who was trafficked as a young woman and now runs a program for trafficked young women and girls. And she said recently, if you told me 20 years ago that the word trafficking and the concept of it would be on the nightly news every single night and be the national obsession, right? A story that we're telling and telling and telling, I wouldn't have believed you. But it's bizarre to me that we're having a national conversation about trafficking and it hasn't yet made any difference. And I found that to be a very profound quote to remind us that we can have these stories on our radar. We can tell these stories and read these stories. But if we're not growing from how we're telling our stories and listening to our stories, then we're stuck. So I invite us to think about the story of Purim and other stories that we tell and retell in our Tanakh, where there's a certain kind of sexual ethics that is being conveyed, whether consciously or subconsciously in these stories, right? We have to be aware of how we are telling these stories, and we have to be focused on how we can grow from how we tell our stories. Okay, that is part one, Esther. Now, another story that is a kind of theme or sub-theme in this time of year, right? We're coming up on Parshat Zachor, the parsha where we read the story of Amalek. And we know that Amalek, right? Haman is a descendant of Amalek, right? That's part of the theme of Purim, is to be on the lookout for Amalek. And I want to now bring a poem by a contemporary Israeli poet that I think weaves these two things together. The sexual ethics part of the story of Esther and the Megillah, and the Amalek part of Purim and the story of Esther and the Megillah. And when we put those together, I think we don't only get a picture of disappointment. I think what we can kind of strive for is to understand our obligation of constant vigilance to create a culture of care, to create a sexual ethics of care, but it actually requires constant vigilance. So here's a poem that is in a collection of poems called Ot Hevel, the mark of Abel, like Cain and Abel. It's a collection of poems written by Shulamit Halevi, who herself is a victim survivor of sexual violence. And this is the last poem. This is the epilogue in that collection. And you can see how Ot Hevel is kind of a funny title, or maybe not funny at all, right? Ot Hevel, the mark, it's not Hevel who gets a mark in the story. Hevel dies in the story. He's killed by Cain. It's Cain, the mark of Cain. Cain has an Ot, right? He has a sign that's essentially a mark of immunity that God gives him so that anybody who might try to harm Cain, who was the perpetrator of violence, will actually not be harmed. So in some ways, this collection of poetry, I think, is about reimagining what if there was sort of a shift and actually it was the one who experienced violence who had that kind of mark, who had that kind of mark of immunity, right? That might be reading too much into the title, but I think it's an invitation to kind of reimagine what our world could look like, where perpetrators wouldn't walk around with immunity. Okay, so here's the poem that is going to pick up on that phrase that we saw about Esther, Esther Karka Olam, Esther as ground of the earth, in that moment where she was being coerced. And it's going to kind of run with that to, I think, tell a complex story of what this image that the Talmud offers us of Esther in that moment of kind of total passivity, what charge we might take from that scene and that story. Okay, this is called She'asani Kirtzono, who made me according to his will. A quote from one of the morning blessings that traditionally woman would say instead of She'lo asani isha, who did not make me a woman. Instead, they say She'asani Kirtzono, who made me according to God's will. But here, I think the right translation is His will. Okay, here's the poem. It's a bit stark. Reach simun territoria zicharit rovitz al yad kes ya. Zachor ki afar anachnu. Karka olam. Hazidonot vahashgagot atamakir haratzon vehaones. The scent marking male territory crouches next to the throne of God. God is mindful that we are but dust, round of the earth, karka olam. Intentional versus unintentional sins, you, God, discern. Will, ratzon, or consent, versus duress or rape. Okay, what is happening in this poem? It's a little bit cryptic. But I want to draw your attention to two things. One is like the center of the poem has this phrase, karka olam, right? The way Esther, as essentially a victim of sexual violence, is depicted by the Talmud, right? That total passivity. But there's a lot more happening here. And that opening scene evokes an image from Amalek, right? Next to the throne of God, Al-Yad Kis Yah is actually a phrase that's coming from the book of Shemot in the scene right after Amalek attacks the people of Israel. And when that's recounted for the first time. So jump down for a second to source 6 here from Shemot, where we have the story of Amalek. Vayavo Amalek. Amalek came. Vayilachem im Yisrael b'Refidim. And fought Israel in Refidim. Okay, this is in Parashat Beshalach. After they've crossed the sea, then they're complaining for water. Then Amalek comes. And they fight, and Yehoshua has a battle, and Moshe has his arms up, and they win. And then you have the lines at the end. God said to Moses, inscribe this in a document as a reminder, read it aloud. I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And Moshe built an altar, named it Hashem Nisi, and said, it seems like Moshe says, the hand upon the throne of God, ki yad al kis ya. God will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. This is this phrase, ki yad al kis ya. Now, what do we make of that? Why are we getting this invocation of this scene of Amalek? It's actually a cryptic phrase to translate there in the text in Shemot. But I think what this opening scene leaves us with in the poem is that, right, it's not that God's throne is in and of itself oppressive or objectifying or kind of the same as male territory. The problem is that the throne has been sort of marked with this scent of male territory. So that's like crouching nearby, but that's not actually God, God's self. Okay. And I think you see this sort of problem of this male abuse of power, right, that sexual coercion represents as a kind of sign of the invasion of Amalek. But that is what it represents. And that's this sort of intrusion on the throne of God, on who God is supposed to be. Okay? So it's, I think, a pretty like powerful image to name the problem of sexual ethics gone wrong as essentially an Amalek problem, right? We have a long tradition of trying to understand who is Amalek. What is Amalek? There's a strong rabbinic tradition that the actual descendants of Amalek are unknown in our generations. And so it becomes a little bit more of a conceptual model, and we know one that can be really abused in our moment to label real people as Amalek. So here she's not labeling any particular individual as Amalek, but she is naming a phenomenon as an Amalek phenomenon, which is the problem of, right, male abuse of power and how that has, right, encroached upon the throne of God. It has tainted the possibility of, you know, God being able to really show up as God in the world, or for us to experience God. Okay, so that's that first scene. And then, right, the poem shifts to Zachor ki afar nachnu. God is mindful that we are but dust, and that being juxtaposed with ground of the earth. So this phrase, Zachor ki afar nachnu, is from Psalms, and is often used to sort of describe how we are, like, we are nothing. It's sort of, it's about our humility. But when she juxtaposes that phrase with karka olam, ground of the earth, right, it becomes, when put together, kind of image of people who are treated like dust or who are treated like dirt, right? So I think she's kind of reinflecting this phrase, ground of the earth, and in the Talmud, perhaps it meant passivity, to read it now as people whose dignity is trampled upon, right? And how a sexual ethics gone wrong can lead to this kind of trampling of dignity, which God is aware of. God, whose throne has been encroached upon, is aware, is mindful of this kind of trampling of dignity that happens in our world. Okay. And then again, right, a turn to God, who knows? God knows the difference between intentional and unintentional sins. This part is a phrase that's a quote from Vidoy, from the confession. God knows the difference between intentional and unintentional sins. God knows the difference between ratzon and ones, which in that prayer is about knowing the difference between sins that are done willfully, ratzon, versus sins that are done under duress. And I think partly what you see here is, you know, a little bit of a plea, perhaps in the face of that passage in the Talmud that would suggest Esther should have been willing to die instead of face this kind of sexual sin. And there's a sort of crying out here that's like, no, God knows when something is duress, and you know, there's no willful or sort of complicit nature in that sexual sin. But I think it's also that so often in our own culture, you can have, right, people who are questioning whether a particular sex act was, well, did she want it or did she not? Right? Questioning whether something was actually coercion. And there's a sense here of like, God knows the truth. God knows the truth. So I see here, there's both a kind of theological crisis about what it means to live in a world where, you know, sexual ethics gone wrong is part of the day in, day out of our reality, and at times all over the headlines of our newspapers, right? Where is God in that picture, right? Sort of, we have theodicy crises about like, how could the Holocaust happen? Where's God if something like the Holocaust can happen? And here there's like a, where's God if something like sexual assault and sexual ethics gone wrong can just be part of our lives? Like, where's God? But then there's also a sense of like, no, but I know where God is. God is there. God does not want this. God is the one who knows the truth and is sort of with me, I hear her saying, knows me, and has just been encroached upon. And right, in that case, right, what does this commandment about Amalek become? What is this never-ending war against Amalek? I think if you go to the second passage here about Amalek, Devarim chapter 25, source 7, you see here what Amalek represents, right? Remember what Amalek did to you on the journey when you left Egypt. Asher karcha baderech, right? It Amalek sort of came upon you on in your travel and took up all those who were weak, kol hanechashalim acharecha, those who were vulnerable at the edge of the camp, cut down the stragglers who were at the rear, right? Attacked those who were vulnerable. That's what Amalek represents. And I think that's what Amalek represents in her poem. You were tired, you were worn out. And then you have this phrase, "Velo yarei Elohim," and didn't fear God. We're going to look in a second about who that applies to. Okay, but the picture here is Amalek is that force that preys on the vulnerable. And she is reading that in particular as Amalek preys on the vulnerable. That is what sexual abuse is about. That is our sexual ethics gone wrong. It's a manifestation of Amalek taking advantage of the vulnerable. And I think this becomes even a little bit more powerful. If you look at source 8, the Mechilta, the Midrash on Amalek, Vayavo Amalek, right? Amalek came. Rabbi Yehoshua says, Nichnas tachat ananei kavod. Amalek somehow managed to penetrate under the clouds of glory, right? There's a problem here. Bnei Israel are traveling surrounded by clouds of glory at all times, we think, according to rabbinic tradition, right? How could it be that Amalek got through, right? They just crossed the sea. They're under divine protection, right? There's a sense of safety that the people have. And somehow Amalek comes and penetrates that sense of safety, right? Kidnaps some some of the people from Israel and killed them. And I think the point here is, you, the people, Israel, you were tired, you were worn out. But Veloyare Elohim is about Amalek. Amalek didn't fear God. And so because they didn't fear God, they somehow were not deterred by the Anane HaKavod. They weren't deterred by the clouds of glory. They didn't fear God. And so they broke through, right? They penetrated that sense of safety. But I think you see here this language that evokes what victims and survivors of sexual violence often describe is like that moment when their sense of safety, of bodily safety and integrity was punctured, was totally thrown off, right? That's what B'nai Israel experienced with that attack from Amalek. That was an invasion of their safety, right? And that is in contrast to, right, other sages say, no, V'lo yirei Elokim, didn't fear God. That refers to Israel, right? This comes right after they complained about water. They said, maybe God isn't in our midst. And so it's the fact that Israel wasn't afraid of God, that essentially they were punished by Amalek coming, right? But this, I think you see sort of two motifs here. One is a sort of guilt motif. It's Israel's fault. It's a version of a blame the victim. It's Israel's fault that Amalek came. And the other is, no, it's Amalek's fault that Amalek came. Amalek didn't fear God. Okay. But the sort of picture here is, I think this is another source, right, that evokes the violence of Amalek in ways that can really very much be ascribed to, right, that can be kind of transposed onto an experience of sexual victimization. And if so, then God saying, I'm going to constantly be at war against Amalek, is essentially a manifestation of the need to constantly be vigilant about this kind of force that can exist in our culture. And I actually think that debate about whether the problem lies with the outsider, right, the outsider who's not afraid of God, or the problem lies within our own community not being afraid of God, right, if you understand that not being afraid of God as somehow having the kind of hubris or ego or whatever it might be that induces somebody to make this kind of attack on somebody else's safety, right, that is what we have to be constantly vigilant about noticing, right? Noticing those forces in order to preserve a culture of dignity and safety. It's not going to end, right? That battle is actually not going to end, right? Almost like, right, we have these passages in Devarim that say you have to constantly give to the poor so there won't be poor, but there will always be the poor, right? We might want this. We should always aspire to not have to fight this fight. But I think what we are seeing here is like the truth is we will always need to fight this fight, right? And that's where telling our stories, retelling our stories, growing in how we tell our stories, but the work is never done here. The image we get through this poem, right, through Shalamit Halevi's poem, and through reading Megillat Esther through this lens and reinterpreting what Amalek is, we now receive this charge to be doing this work constantly. And, you know, instead of wishing that the work wasn't there to be done, instead of wishing that we somehow like reached a certain point of progress and now we don't have to spend as much energy on this work, this is a very clear message. We will always need to spend a lot of energy on this work. Hopefully we grow and the kind of work we have to do changes as we grow, but the work is there. Okay, that is our retelling of the story of Esther through this lens of sexual ethics and taking up the charge of constant vigilance to create a culture that cares. Right? And I think the last piece I'll say on this is, right, if that source about Ahasuerus was about the culture of a different kingdom, right? The culture of a kingdom under a king who was not the Jewish leader and who we didn't, I don't know, elect, right? It's a situation where we're just sort of like facing the culture imposed by a leadership that we're not responsible for. I think what we see in this final source and that question of, okay, who wasn't fearing God? Was it Israel or was it the external power? Right? You see that like we have to take responsibility to have the culture, including the leaders, who will make that, who will express care and concern for dignity and understand that it's an ongoing fight. Okay. I want to close out this evening and this session with the Song of Songs. And I think a sort of beautiful imagery here that invites us to a sexual ethics of emerging or re-emerging, right? We've been talking a lot about disappointment, honesty around realities that are not what we wish they would be. And here I want us to kind of embrace the possibility of a sexual ethics that's really an invitation towards, right, emerging into delight and a sexual ethics of care, of actualization, and of growth. So there's a verse in the Song of Songs. Ani chavatzelet ha-sharon shoshanat ha-amakim. I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys, in chapter 2. And that chapter later goes on in what is perhaps more famous to say, right, oh my dove in the cranny of the rocks, hidden by the cliff, let me see your face, let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is comely. Yonati b'chagvei ha-sela b'seter ha-madriga har'ini et mar'ayich hashmi'ini et kolech. Right, let me see you, let me hear your voice. So you have an image here of hiding and emerging from being hidden. And I think it's that scene at the end of the chapter that is the kind of invitation or provocation for the Midrash to take that word for Rose of Sharon, Chavatzelet HaSharon, and interpret it in a kind of narrative way as a story about being hidden and then emerging from being hidden. So if you turn to our last source here, from the Midrash, Shir HaShirim Rabbah, where we know the rabbis take the poetic story of lovers in the Song of Songs and give it a narrative and theological valence. It becomes the story of God and Israel falling in love. And this brings us back to our first session, where we were reaching towards a theology of mutual ratzon, a theology of intimacy that is rooted in care for the other person's will, right? Mutual care for the other person's will and desire. So we're going to close here now with Shir HaShirim that reads the intimacy and relationship in the Song of Songs as about between God and Israel. So we have here, Ani chavatzelet ha-sharon, I am a rose of Sharon. Ani hi v'chaviva ani, I am she and beloved am I. So first taking chavatzelet to be like chaviva, I am beloved. But how does the belovedness manifest? What does this intimacy look like? What does it look like to be in a relationship of belovedness? Shahiti chavuya b'tzilan shel Mitzrayim. I am she who was hidden in the shadow of Egypt. Chavatzelet, chavuya b'tzel. Okay? So instead of the name of a flower, we're going to atomize that word, chavatzelet, into two words. Chavuya b'tzel. I was hidden in the shadow. It was sort of crouching, hidden in the shadow of Egypt, right? This is what we were when we were slaves in Egypt. And then God came in, meaning this relationship of love and intimacy enters the scene. And in a short time, the Holy Blessed One gathered me to Ramses, right? That's the first point in the Exodus. That's where they go first, right? So this is the very beginning of redemption, or the very beginning of our relationship of love and intimacy with God. And I bloomed with good deeds like a lily. Imagine sort of all these little buds of a lily of the valley, sort of studded with good deeds. And I said before God a song, right? Shira, like Sharon, Rose of Sharon. I erupted in song, deed and song. As it is said, you will have song on the night of the sanctified feast. This is a verse in Isaiah that is read in Midrash to reflect the moment, the night of the Exodus, right? Even before the people get to the crossing of the sea and the Torah records their song, according to Midrash, we sang a song that night that we left Egypt. Okay. So what do we see here, and why do I think it's so important and beautiful as a way to end? Right. We see that what it means to be in this relationship of intimacy with God is to come out, right? To move, to emerge from a place of smallness, right? Hiddenness, crouching in this shadow of Egypt, and to move into expressiveness, right? By virtue of being in this relationship of love and intimacy with God, right? God is invested in our actualization, self-expression, both in deed and in voice. And that is, right, that's this sort of picture that we've been playing with from the beginning, right? That sexual ethics and ethics of intimacy that's rooted in a mutual investment in the other's expression, the other's will. It sort of goes beyond a basic requirement for consent into actually wanting the other to emerge into the fullness of their being. And when you see this, I think, as commentary in the Song of Songs, to emerge into their own delight and desire and expression. Now, the Midrash goes on and repeats this scene three more times. And the last time it repeats it, it's in our own moment. I am she who was, or perhaps is, hidden and trampled in the shadow of the kingdoms, right? Even though God redeemed us once and sort of forged this relationship at the beginning of our relationship with God, it was a liberatory relationship of moving into self-expression. We got trampled on again, right? Sort of hidden, trampled on again. I invite us to read this through that lens of Amalek. But there's the forces in our culture that move towards trampling dignity. And yet, tomorrow, lemachar, right? We believe that our intimacy with God will result in our thriving and our voice emerging in a new song. And similarly, I want us to sort of imagine, even as we face disappointment after disappointment around how sexual ethics plays out in our world, and we're going to look at that honestly and not just wish it away, and we're going to imagine that it is possible to emerge from the hidden, trampled state into a reality of relationships, of intimacy, and a sexual ethics that is actually rooted in mutual care and investment in the other's full expression. I'll just close by kind of reminding us where we've gone here in this series. We began with a particular moment of disappointment when a woman in the Talmud approached a rabbi, disclosing her experience of sexual violence, and his initial response was, it seems like total misunderstanding, to ask whether she may have enjoyed it. And that moment represented disappointment in religious leadership. And I was suggesting it could kind of be a microcosm for disappointment we may feel when we encounter our sacred texts as well. And it feels like they misunderstand, or worse. And often it feels like that kind of initial moment of disappointment, it just gets worse and worse. It only has one direction to go, and that's kind of downhill. But in the Talmud, where we began in that story, the story didn't end there with the disappointment, right? We saw how she spoke up, tried to convey her experience in terms the rabbi could understand, and he listened, and that had profound impact on the law. What starts as coercion is coercion. Now, we have a lot more questions you could ask about this story, right? Whether it was true or not, whether the way she had to explain herself was sort of demeaning to her experience, try to put it in terms the rabbi would understand. Lots we could probe there, but the idea was like that was a moment that didn't end in disappointment. There was listening and learning that happened there. It was messy. Maybe it wasn't complete, but it was something. And her words changed the way he approached sexual ethics. So I want to sort of invite us all to jump in into that stage, the listening and learning, to insist that there has to be listening and learning. We're not just going to settle for disappointment. And tonight we focus on growth, looking at the sexual ethics embedded in one of the stories we tell each year in Esther, and to try to find pathways of growth in how we retell that story, at least the way sexual ethics appears in that story. As we saw in the poem by Shulamit Halevi, the work of confronting these forces in our culture that can strip away dignity, take advantage of vulnerability, Amalek, it's ongoing hard work. And we have to really constantly want to strive for a culture that cares. And finally, we close with Shir HaShirim, the delight of the lovers in the garden, which for the Midrash that we saw, it's not a rose-colored idealistic picture, unaware of darker moments. It starts in the dark. It starts in the shadow. And the sexual ethics that we strive for is one that really has to be ready to see and face disappointment, to also see the realities of those who are maybe literally hiding away in shadows, feeling small, feeling alone, and to imagine a movement towards reemergence, towards self-expression and depth of voice. Hashmi'ini et kolech. This is the liberatory intimate relationship God began with us when we left Egypt. And even as the world throws dignity after indignity, we must dream that it is possible to emerge differently, to emerge out of these shadows. That sexual ethics is about growth and not just disappointment. Like the Rose of Sharon, like the Lily of the Valley, it's not the story of a delicate flower, but of a powerful self-expression that's grounded in resilience. Radical Ratzon, a theological ethics of mutual dignity and mutual delight.